Hi, kids. Welcome to Bronco Land. We got some smart ones in the room.
Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. It has been a while since we've had one. Obviously, we've been pretty busy here with the start of training camp, the announcement of the partnership with UC Health Training Center, the new name of the practice facility, including the indoor and everything here where the Broncos headquarters are, is now UC Health Training Center.
Yeah, there never really was an all-encompassing name for the whole training center, like the whole complex. You have the Paul D. Bowlen Memorial Broncos Center, which is the building in which the locker room sits, the coaches' offices are, and staff offices are. But there was never, you know, and has this complex has grown from what it was in 1990 when it opened, when it was just the Paul D. Bowlen Memorial Broncos Center and some practice fields and a bubble. There was never like a name that kind of, you know, that officially was dubbed for the whole thing. Of course, Dove Valley was used colloquially because that's the area in which it sits. So
it was
now,
a good catch-all, but yeah, it wasn't really
right. Now it's got a name, the UC Health Training Center. I was actually standing on the practice field yesterday, and I was counting from my angle how many places can I see the words UC Health Training Center just within eyeshot, and I count and. Because it's on all four sides of the video tower, but I could only see two from my angle. So there's two there, and there was three. It said three times on the concrete below, and then I saw it once on the indoor facility, and then once back on the Paul D. Bowlen Memorial Center. So seven places within eyeshot, you could see the words UC Health Training Center.
Good branding.
Yes. Good branding.
And Darren Rodvell would be proud.
Yeah. And how many times, like, if you've watched bits of training camp, whether if you haven't been out here, but you've seen clips online on DenverBroncos.com or you're watching the NFL Network coverage on Monday or the ESPN coverage on Friday, UC Health is getting its money's worth out of this, I think, because it's being splashed everywhere. And that doesn't even mention how it's on the sign out front, which used to just say Denver Broncos Football Club. Now it still says Denver Broncos Football Club, albeit with the logo and not the old 1980s graphic faux 3D helmet.
It kind of needed an update. But
it needed an update. I kind of like the old school one. But
I did too.
You know, now you see UC Health there, so certainly it's a symbiotic partnership, I think. You know, it's good for the Broncos to, because I know for years they've tried to get a sponsor's name on the facility, as many teams have, and good for UC Health for all the pub they're getting.
Well, I think now we just need to get some DenverBroncos.com signage out there.
Yeah, there's spots.
There's
places.
Spots.
I mean, you know.
I mean, I'm just saying it'd be nice to have our name out there too.
I would say
on NFL Network.
Yes. although Chris Hall did get on NFL Network in the background.
I saw
catching a football,
showing off his training camp skills himself.
Yes. Well, I mean he's he's ready to go. I mean he does.
I think this is his favorite time of the year. Just being honest, he loves being out there during team and everything and getting those shots.
The shots that no one else can get, because remember the only place to see actual practice video is DenverBroncos.com. So, just saying. But you probably knew that because you're here listening.
Yes, and I'll repeat that again. The only place to see highlight footage of Denver Broncos training camp action, DenverBroncos.com.
It's the only
You can just come to the practices themselves, which are open to fans. Most
true
of them are. Which has been pretty popular, save for the weekend, which is pretty weird, I thought.
Yeah, the first two weekend practices, Saturday and Sunday, actually had the lowest attendances so far. And I've tried to kind of figure out why, and maybe it's as simple.
Here's my logic.
Okay, go ahead.
People would rather miss work than they would rather miss their day off.
That's true. I could see that. I was going for something simpler, like there was the excitement of the first day on Friday, but then people realized that the pads weren't going to be on, full pads weren't going to be on until Monday, so they waited to come down. The other thing that happens is you see a lot of kids at training camp, and for kids that do, you know, whether they're, you know, in some in a camp type program or They have that. There's a stay-at-home parent, whether it's their own or one of their friends, and you figure, okay, let's go midweek because maybe it won't be as crowded as it is on the weekend. It turns out it's more crowded. But yeah, the average of 4,134 per training camp practice so far. That's significant because in the years at Dove Valley, when there were fans at training camp, 2003 to 2013, before last year, fans couldn't be around because of construction. The highest average was 2,872. I'm reading this right off of an old press release from 2013.
Looks like when maybe a 75% increase.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I mean, most of the years, like, the big crowds did not really start until 2012. We all know what happened in 2012. Yes. Yeah. Strangely enough, if you look at 05 to 09, only one of those years did the Broncos average more than 1,000 people per Dove Valley practice. And now crowds of 4,000 plus are the norm. And
they've added a lot of amenities to go with just the excitement of football.
Yeah, you miss the trees, but you got misters. It's a much more convenient experience now. I think you can see better. Although I think it's interesting how when the first people that get into practice, they crowd down toward the bottom of the hill. Mm-hmm. And that's better for being in a potential autograph position, which may be some people's priorities. But if your priority is to watch camp, you're better off actually coming a little bit later when all that's left are the seats up high. Because I think the up high view is the best view.
Well, you get to see all three fields.
Yeah, in NFL training camp, especially if you bring some binoculars, you can zoom right in, watch the line drills, and then when they go into team periods, take them off and just watch the plays flow. I mean, it's a phenomenal way to watch training camp. It's something that really hasn't existed here before.
Now, this is my first training camp, and I've really enjoyed what I've been able to see when I've been able to just get in and just watch practice from beginning to end. I think you've said it before, your favorite part is the line drill one-on-ones.
Mm-hmm. Always.
I mean, I think from what I saw on Tuesday, that was Von Miller's favorite part, too.
You picked a good day to pay attention to that. That was, of course.
Well, the first time I think they had it on the second field, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I have to.
It's hard for the media to see it from the field. Maybe it was over there.
It's been over on the third field sometimes as well, but on the second field, it was actually. It was a good view actually, and that was a day where those of us in the laptop and notebook set could kind of go up and go onto the bleachers and get up a little high and watch it. And of course, if you were paying attention to line drills and not 7-on-7, that meant you saw Von Miller go under Ryan Harris's arm in a pass rush move without losing any speed. That's the thing; he has such good balance and body control when he gets low that he just sprints. He can sprint under and below and below a tackle, and his
bend is incredible.
Yeah, and he knew it because like the moment he got past him and got to where the quarterback would have been, he just kept right. He turned and kept right on sprinting. Sprinted all the way back about 50 yards to the doors to the locker room. I couldn't see. Did he actually go in? Did he actually open the door?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Because we couldn't see from our angle.
It's always great when you have those moments. You know, obviously your opponent is not going to be one of the ones joining in. But when it elicits your teammates just hollering and yelling out.
Yeah.
That's just a really exciting moment, even though it can be kind of...
It's a little more clear on the us versus them dynamic when another team is here. So when the 49ers come in, and it won't be part of training camp, but because it's not open to the public, unfortunately, but it will be something that we're covering pretty heavily. It'll be when we see stuff like that, it'll be, Von Miller beating, Joe Staley, and I think you won't say, oh, beat one of our guys. It'll be beat one of their guys. It'll be all good, but... Yeah, on the one hand, Von Miller is We know he's a freakish athlete. To me, he looks like he's finally all the way back from the torn ACL that he had in late 2013. It seems like everyone looks at his 2014 season and says, "Oh, well, it was a little bit disappointing." But he was coming off an ACL, a 14 sack season in which he was also one of the league's better run defending outside linebackers. Less than 12 months removed from a torn ACL, it's pretty darn good, I think. In the grand scheme of things. But now, to me, it looks like his quickness and his agility is really back. And, being in a 3-4 scheme that I think favors him and favors DeMarcus Ware's skill set as well, if Von Miller stays healthy this year, I think this could be the year that I think this could be the career year for him. Or hopefully one of them, and hopefully there are more to come. But this could be the year where he sets his standards.
Defensively, that's probably the most exciting parts to watch. I mean, in some of the team drills or 7-on-7s, the secondary gets in there. Akeem Tweed had a pretty spectacular pick on Tuesday.
Yes.
But as far as some of the things that people might not be able to catch, some of the finer points, what have you seen from the middle linebackers there with maybe some of the depth?
Well, we've seen Danny Trevathan and Brandon Marshall work in 7-on-7. So their work has just been in pass coverage. It's pretty clear that the Broncos are projecting them being ready to go full tilt for week one, because when you come out for the media walkthroughs in the afternoons, they're working together as the inside linebackers. So it's clear where this is going. That being said, Wade Phillips talked about the depth at linebacker, so that's the best he's seen. Todd Davis looks really good. Steven Johnson, good against the run. Still having some issues from time to time in pass coverage. If you watched last year's Bengals game last year, you probably know what I'm talking about. He's a classic two-down thumper. That's his role, and of course, an expansive role on special teams. That's what he does best. Todd Davis, on the other hand, he's a potential three-down linebacker. And, what I like about him, good instincts on being able to follow how the play develops and get to the hole and make sure he's in the right spot. There's been a bunch of times that when I've watched run plays, both in 9-on-7 and team drills, that, he correctly diagnosed the fact that, the play was flowing one way, but the running back was going in the other direction, and he was able to kind of read that and make sure he got to the right spot to be in position to get to the ball carrier. That kind of experience and savviness, that's something you expect from a guy who's got a lot more experience than Todd Davis, just going into his second year and who only joined the team at midseason as a waiver claim from New Orleans. I think his development's pretty exciting to watch, and even if Trevathan and Marshall stay healthy this year, I think it may well have a long term impact, of course, because Trevathan's contract is expiring after this year. But the bigger thing is Marshall's still coming off the foot injury, Trevathan's still coming off of the injuries around his knee, and you've got to have someone who you can trust, and the Broncos have at least two someones. Todd Davis, and then certainly Steven Johnson in that base package role, and Lameen Barrow and Corey Nelson, they've had some moments as well, and are going to factor in on special teams. So certainly the depth is looking very good, and I would say that it needs to, because when you have two starting inside linebackers both coming off of season-ending injuries, you want to make sure you have a pretty solid insurance policy in case one of them can't, at least one of them or both can't go all 16.
I can't help but think that Todd Davis's trajectory kind of similar to Brandon Marshall's, given I think, Todd was picked up a little bit later in the season than Brandon was when he was cut by the
And Brandon was a second was also in his second year as well when he came here, because he had a season in Jacksonville. So it was, New Orleans,
they were just hoping to sneak something by the entire league.
They didn't want him. They didn't want to lose him, but they were trying, they were in a roster squeeze, and
but their defense can handle it. Their defense was okay without another impact player.
I mean, darn! You look back now at them. I look at their roster on defense, and I think, boy, Todd, you know, we're talking about Todd Davis being a backup here. He'd start down there. I think he'd start with no questions. But sometimes, you know, getting into a different situation, it's better for you. Who's to say that New Orleans would have found out what it had in Todd Davis if he'd stayed down there? Maybe he would have lingered on the practice squad the rest of the season.
That's always a question that. Yeah. For this is regardless of sport, but yeah. Finding the right fit for every player is of the utmost importance. Yeah. Like, I mean, some players can do well wherever they go.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when I look at like basketball, a guy like Kawhi Leonard, had he gone to a team like the Charlotte Bobcats or something, mm-hmm. probably would not have become much less a Finals MVP, but would not have had the same kind of impact that I think he'd have with the surrounding talent on the Spurs.
Yeah, it's funny because every so often that subject comes up with Russell Wilson,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, John Elway has talked about how much the Broncos liked him going into the 2012 draft, but they went with Brock Osweiler. Now what would Russell Wilson be if he'd come here? He'd still be waiting on his first start.
Yeah,
people wouldn't know who he was outside of Denver and North Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, his hometown, and Madison, Wisconsin. You know,
would he have played baseball?
Yeah, he might have. Might he have gotten frustrated sitting behind Peyton Manning waiting for his shot and said, "Okay, I want to go." Want to go play for the Texas Rangers or might the Rockies have held on to his rights? Who knows? It's a great what if. And let's say another team had picked Russell Wilson. Who's to say he would have had the same opportunity that he had in Seattle? It just turned out that the Seahawks didn't have a clear cut number one. They'd signed Matt Flynn, but he'd never really been an every week starter. It's interesting to kind of look back on how the right you get a guy in the right situation. Obviously, I'm sure I know it frustrates Broncos fans because he's been a part of teams that have beaten the Broncos twice. But you will twist your mind into a pretzel if you start looking at all those scenarios.
True enough. Going back to training camp, we have not been at a lack for huge plays on offense either. I think Cody Latimer has really stood out to me as a guy who's really grown into his kind of replacement role in the first team. But, I mean, he and Peyton have really connected on a lot of passing plays.
They've got their timing down. And, Latimer, whether it's in team 7-on-7 or one-on-one, he's consistently making plays, and he's making plays against guys like Aqib Talib. I mean, this isn't, he's not shredding, backups and guys who don't have a great chance to be around once the roster gets down to 53. He's beating really good players. And the other thing, the thing you notice is that the more Manning throws to him, the narrower the windows are. He has that trust in Cody Latimer to know that he only has to have just a little bit of space, and that Latimer can come down with the football. He trusts his hands. He trusts his athleticism. Obviously, we're going to see a lot of two tight end or two back formations from the Broncos. I think that's going to depend on a lot of times where the fullback / tight end lines up. But Cody Latimer is making a case to say, hey, don't forget about the three wide sets. Maybe make a little more use of them than perhaps was in the initial plan, because once you get Demaryius Thomas back out there, you have Demaryius Thomas and Cody Latimer as the two wide guys, and then you have Emmanuel Sanders as the slot. That's pick your poison right there. And, I mean, obviously, you're probably going to have a lot of two tight end or two back sets early because you're concerned about the blocking up front with the reshuffled offensive line. But boy, I mean, hopefully for the Broncos, there's going to be some moments where they go three wide, because that could be a pretty devastating trio with Latimer and backing up Sanders and Demaryius Thomas.
I tend to think we'll see more Latimer, especially in, maybe in the early preseason games. But as DT gets his conditioning back, you know, maybe they'll take him out for a third down or second down or something, and Cody will get his chance with the first team, at least in the preseason games. I figure DT will be 100%.
And maybe in the regular season as well, you find those windows to say, okay, take a series. I mean, we talk about resting guys at other positions, and when we talk about using Shane Ray to spell DeMarcus Ware and Von Miller on occasion, but I think mostly DeMarcus Ware to make sure he's fresh so he can sustain his production over the course of the year and hopefully not have the kind of second half fade that he did when, you know, probably for a guy of his experience, probably was used a little too much early out of necessity. But you have the other positions. I think certainly at running back, you know, C.J. Anderson looks like he's going to be the number one back, but I think we're going to see plenty of Monte Ball, and we should see plenty of Monte Ball because he's had some nice runs of his own, and that keeps him fresh. Why not have the same kind of concept at wide receiver, where you say, okay, man, you can sit this series out. We're gonna spout you with Cody. Demaryius, you can say the same thing with Demaryius Thomas. Cody's gonna give you a breather here, and then when you factor in the three wide sets when they're all out on the field, all of a sudden, you can look at a game and say, wow, Cody Latimer played 50% of the snaps.
Yeah.
And I think that would be ideal because he's earning that playing time. He's basically, with what he does every day, he's daring the team to say, okay, daring the team not to play him. Because right now, he looks like he could step out there and be an elite receiver from week one onward.
Now, I think we've staved off the question of the offensive line long enough in this podcast as it's probably one of the main things people think about, especially fans who are starting to get anxious for the beginning of the regular season. You mentioned to me maybe a day or two ago that Tyson Brailo has lived up to the intelligence that everyone has talked about, how quick a learner he is. How have you seen that?
Well, what I've seen from him, first of all, is he's doing a better job getting set quickly, but also remaining light on his feet. That's a delicate balance because, you know, you want your left tackle to have a good base and get set up, but you don't want him to be unable to respond to a guy spinning inside or outside. You want him to be able to have some quick feet. That was one of the things that I know stood out to the Broncos on the tape when they were studying him before they drafted him. And you're starting to see that now. Guys, what I saw a little bit of in the OTAs and then saw the first couple of days in camp where guys would kind of get a little shove on him and spin and go by him. That hasn't happened as much in the last three practices. I think it's starting to click for him. And frankly, DeMarcus Ware has a lot to do with that. I know you wrote about it, how the veterans on the other side of the line of scrimmage are helping the young guys along. They're telling them, hey, you know, when you set up this way, I could tell you were doing this, so, you know, try to disguise it a little bit better, stuff like that. And the progress I've seen from Cimbrilo, it's really promising. But I don't want to dismiss the progress other young offensive linemen are making. Max Garcia is getting better and better every day. And now his technical play is starting to catch up to his tenacity, which has that's always been his calling card. You know, going back to when he was at Florida, and then he showed it at the Senior Bowl when he's going up against Danny Shelton, who I saw a report from Brown's training camp on Wednesday morning that said that Shelton is getting double teamed and they're still not stopping him. You know, he's 350, 360 pounds of just of utter interior ornery beast. And
I would just love it when there's like a 10 word descriptor for like a defensive lineman. I always love that. There's like massive trains.
Massive trains that they just keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. And when I was down in Mobile at the Senior Bowl in January, Shelton was just dominating one interior offensive lineman after another to the point where guys were almost just kind of, you know, I wouldn't say giving up, but certainly were kind of capitulating a little bit. The guy that fought him the most, that was the most persistent, yeah, he'd get beat, but boy, he stuck with him to the last, was Max Garcia. And that, if you have that kind of tenacity and persistence, those are good building blocks, and then eventually the technical stuff is probably going to come. I see a little bit of that in Matt Paradis as well. You know, these are two, you know, Paradis, quote unquote, undersized. You know, Sylvester Williams, who's had a great camp. There's been times where Sylvester has blown by him, but more and more what you're seeing is that even when Sylvester gets a move on him to one side, that Paradis, he gets his hands up quick, and he's able to kind of fight him and kind of turn it into a little bit of a street brawl between the two of them. And Garcia does the same kind of thing. And that, I think, has really got to excite the coaching staff, because they know this offensive line is going to be young. Mm-hmm. They don't know how young it's going to be. Frankly, that's going to depend on how guys like Garcia and Paradis develop, and, you know, eventually you figure they'd like them to start, but when that happens. But I think they're certainly on the right path. And then, you know, even some of the older, the veteran guys, I think Gino Gradkowski, I thought he had his best day on Tuesday, the fifth day of training camp. I think his experience in the zone blocking scheme is starting to show. There was one play I noticed, like, with him and Lou Vasquez just pulling out perfectly, and CJ just went right through and took off up the field, and they had a little, and Lou and Gino had a little fist bump. That's as exuberant as those two are going to get, because they're very business-like players on the field. But more and more, even though the offensive line, there's a lot of question marks, and they're not going to go away. And like Rick Dennison said on Tuesday, a lot's going to be put on how they do in preseason games. But now, you know, whereas on Friday and Saturday, it looked really rough and maybe downright scary at times from the perspective of some fans. But now more and more, even though there are some plays where guys are getting beat, they're holding their own. If they can hold their own against a defense that's got DeMarcus Ware and Von Miller coming off the edges every play, then I think it's a good shot they're going to be able to hold their own once we get to the regular season.
One person who has kind of risen up the ranks was right tackle Ryan Harris, a late add in this offseason because of Ryan Clady's injury. He was added to kind of shore up the tackle depth as the Broncos kind of figure out those spots. He's been working with the first team.
Yeah, and you know what you're getting with Ryan Harris in this scheme, because he's he's been in it for most of his career. Some exceptions. Kansas City did some different things with him last year when he was there.
Is it more about durability?
Well, yeah, I'll get to that. Mm-hmm. Like in 2009 and 2010. He was still with the Broncos, but they were starting to go away from the zone blocking base scheme. So he did some different things then, even though he remained as the right tackle. But this is the scheme for which he was drafted back in 07. Again, the big concern is his back. It was that basically forced him to take a year off in 2011, and that's the one big question: how long is his back going to hold up? When he came back to the Broncos and then they let him go, he ended up going down to Houston and having a solid season for Kubiak and Dennison. So that was a positive sign. He stayed relatively healthy last year. But, you wonder how long it's going to hold up, and with his back, how, you know, when he has to get low, can he get low? But as far as the footwork and as far as knowing this scheme, he's stable. You know what you're getting with Ryan Harris, and if he stays healthy, I think he'll be what they're looking for on the right side.
Now coming up, we're going to have training camp returning on Thursday. However, I will not be here. I will be going to Canton as our own Tom Jackson, Ring of Fame linebacker. Does not get quite inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. However, does receive a heaping of recognition for his talents as a broadcast personality for ESPN. Mm-hmm. With everything he's done for, I think, more than three decades.
This is going to be his 29th season in the broadcast chair for ESPN. And I think I was pondering TJ's career recently, and he wasn't the first African American NFL broadcaster. There were others, but he was the first. He was one of the first ones that really stuck and had a had a long term role, and he's really kind of I think helped pave the way for a much more diverse collection mm-hmm. of broadcasters than we had back in the mid to late 1980s when he was doing it. I mean, gosh, you had you had Ahmad Rashad on NBC.
When did Stuart Scott come?
Stuart Scott was local in that he didn't go national until the 90s. Jim Hill.
Because it seemed like
Jim Hill did some play-by-play on CBS back in the day. But in 1987, there were not many African-American broadcasters covering the NFL on a national basis.
And when it comes
Irv Cross as well. Irv Cross was another guy. Irv Cross, Ahmad Rashad, Jim Hill. I apologize if I'm missing any, but Tom Jackson was one of the first ones. And boy, and his transition was seamless because mm-hmm. he went straight from the playing field to, to ESPN. And he got there at the right time. ESPN had just gotten the NFL contract, which was this was a massive deal for games to go to cable.
Right.
This when it happened, it shook the landscape. It was a sign of cable/satellite television's legitimacy, and they had half a season of games, but their tentpole programs were game day and NFL primetime, and it was Chris Berman and Tom Jackson and the late great Pete Axtelm, a phenomenal writer who went into on-air commentary first for NBC and then for ESPN. And game day and prime time at the end of the day was must watch. That mm-hmm. it was the first show. You had prime time, and then a few days later, the highlights on Inside the NFL on HBO that were from NFL films, and those were the only shows that really gave you highlights by the fire hose. Other than that, it was bits and pieces, and it was all your local team. But primetime would actually have 3 or 4 minutes on the bigger games, and kind of tell, and you could kind of get a little bit into what happened. In 1987, this was revolutionary, and
there wasn't internet in 1987.
It was an academic thing. It was if I couldn't be home, I lived in Tampa at the time, and would go to the Bucks games. And if the Bucks played a late afternoon game instead of an early game, I would tape the show and watch it when I got home because of course I always wanted to see how they treated the Bucks. Of course, the Bucks were bad back then, so often not very well. They actually, when Stuart Scott went over to primetime in the 90s, they had a rotating cast. Like Stu Scott did it for a few years. Robin Roberts mm-hmm. was on the show. Bill Pito, I think that there may have been somebody else at some point. But they always had a third. Once after Pete Axtelm died, they would bring in a third narrator for the game highlights. And the Bucks were so bad that they often got the third person. I think they used to say "stew." Remember the term "stew game"?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
A
yes,
stew
yes,
game. Yes. I mean, inevitably, Stu would get the highlights of 2-4-10 teams.
Mm-hmm.
Duking it out. That was the stew. Those were the stew games, and the Bucks had a lot of stew games over the years, as I recall. But back to TJ. I mean, just Chris Berman. I think gets a lot of the attention because he had the nicknames and the shtick and all that. But I mean, Tom Jackson, he was a perfect complement, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
He had, he would rein Berman in, but he would have some fun with it as well. I mean, every time there was a player from TJ's beloved alma mater, the University of Louisville, if it was a big play, I think Berman would say so-and-so from Ernest Givens from Louisville. And then if Ernest Givens fumbled, Ernest Givens from, and he'd go, Louisville.
Our own Jim Sakamano wrote a story about Tom Jackson's ascent in broadcasting. And Sacco's been around for ages with the Broncos. He's still around. He's not in exactly a PR capacity anymore, but he likes to relive those days, and he remembers when DJ moved over to TV. And it wasn't as simple as just, I'm just going to go to ESPN. Now, DJ had some experience, and people were chasing after him. People wanted him desperately. He had contracts on the table, and he nearly went with, like, NBC or something.
Yeah.
And instead, he chose
the it would have been start. It would have been a game analyst role with NBC, right? I believe it was that he would have been just one of the guys on one of the regional broadcasts, if I'm not mistaken. ESPN, of course, gave him a national platform. People who didn't really know Tom Jackson, well, they learn about him quickly. I mean, and the fact is that now most people know Tom Jackson as a broadcaster, and his Hall of Fame induction in that capacity is appropriate. It's richly deserved, and hopefully he'll continue on the air for a while because, you know, ESPN, there's a lot of critiques of it and criticisms of its style and, you know, what airs on a daily basis. I think some of that is justified. But to me, Tom Jackson, more and more, has been that adult in the room, the guy who has the guy who has the gravitas to call out something or someone. The guy who when he's on the set, I'll watch, just because of his presence. You know that when Tom Jackson is there, you know, even though there are other non-serious and silly programs on ESPN, but you know when Tom Jackson is there, that it's legitimate.
Like, right.
he walks into the room and he immediately elevates whatever program he's on. He's even before I came out to cover the Broncos, he was just about my favorite guy to in terms of those who cover the NFL nationally. And so I'm thrilled for him, and honestly, the chances I get to see him around, I'm actually a little starstruck because I'm 9, 10, 11 years old, either watching him play linebacker or watching him on TV. I mean, he's one of my heroes.
A well-deserved honor for him, and we will be there. Broncos TV will be there. We have a enclave going up there. I will be going up there for the written and photo side, and we will have some videographers there as we document this. We will have a few of our Hall of Fame players going up there as well to join the ceremonies that will be going along with the Hall of Fame weekend. So we will have it covered from all angles, and Mace and the crew back here at the UCHTC, as we
I'm holding down the fort. They don't send me on the road aside from Bronco games, they don't send me on the road until draft time. So,
or Pro Bowl.
You know,
we got you out there for the Pro Bowl.
Yeah, for a couple of days.
That was a tough timing because Senior Bowl to
Pro Bowl was interesting. And if the obviously we hope we're at the Super Bowl this year covering the Broncos. But if they're not in there, I don't know if Mobile to Honolulu is going to be possible this year.
They don't have a direct flight from Mobile to Honolulu.
Not even from it would have to be from New Orleans. To get to Phoenix, I drove to New Orleans because it was quicker. I had them fly me out of Louis Armstrong International Airport, which is a 2-hour drive from Mobile.
Now that is an airport name I can get behind.
I don't want to call it New Orleans Airport. It's Louis Armstrong. I mean, come on, man. I mean, If you've got a cool name, own it. Yeah. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having a name like Charlotte Douglas Airport.
It's fine.
It's okay. It's not Louis Armstrong.
It is not.
Hartsfield Jackson in Atlanta.
They should rename Charlotte's the Romare Bearden Airport.
How about they name it after one of the movies they shot in Charlotte Airport? Which, if you walk around, you can see posters for. I think
great movies like Nell. And Shallow Hal, and
Leatherheads.
I think Thunder Road was that. That might have been shot in Charlotte.
I believe also Talladega Nights.
Yes,
part of that was shot in Charlotte. Yes,
one of my brother's good friends growing up is in that movie with the small speaking role.
Because a lot of it was in at the Lowe's Motor Speedway. And what was his speaking role?
He was the pizza delivery boy, who.
Like, oh yeah!
Who I gave Will Ferrell's character a lot of crap. So yeah, that was a small role. My father's a general contractor, and one of his friends worked on one of the houses that you remember. There's a dinner party or some kind of lunch party, like in a backyard.
Yes.
In this house. So that was one of the houses that my dad's friend worked on.
Oh, okay.
So he got to hang around that. He said Will Ferrell was actually a little bit more serious than he expected.
Wow. Well, you can't always be.
You can't be a goofball.
On. You can't. Yeah. And any actor has to think about his or her craft. You know. Where do I want?
Even Will Ferrell.
even with a character as vacuous as Ricky Bobby, clearly. Beyond driving, there is nothing. Beyond the ability to drive, there is nothing north of the chin with this guy, except his endorsement of the Knock Show fountain. That was pretty cool. And actually,
I forgot.
I wanted to have a Knock Show fountain at my own wedding, but we sell for a Knock Show bar.
I nearly forgot there was a restaurant that I never went to, but
Applebee's.
No. I've been to an Applebee's, so wrong on that count, but it was, in the movie there, it's kind of like where the, what's his name? Borat, the guy who plays
Sacha
Borat.
Baron Cohen.
Yeah. They kind of meet at this bar, and that was a restaurant called like the Pit Stop or Wing. It wasn't Wing Stop, but it was some kind of big wing restaurant over near Park Road Shopping Center. They filmed that there.
It's not there anymore. It used to be Quaker Steak and Lube. I think that was the place.
It might have been.
In Park Road Shopping Center, because I lived near there.
You lived near there.
Yeah, I think that was it. But it closed up like 7 or 8 years ago, I believe.
Hardly surprising.
Yeah.
I'm looking at films from Charlotte. I think one of those Hunger Games was shot in North Carolina.
Yeah.
So not quite Charlotte, but
up toward Asheville, I believe.
Yeah, that might be the most famous one these days.
And part of Forrest Gump was shot in North Carolina as well.
I had no
idea. If you're familiar with the scenes where he's running, part of it was...
That's a big part of it.
Yes. part of his run across the country was shot on the grounds of the Biltmore Estate in Asheville, and part of it was shot around Grandfather Mountain. Which, depending on how you get from Charlotte to Asheville, is kind of sort of on the way.
I'm not... I know there's a big initiative to get movies filmed in North Carolina, but I think that's kind of gone the wayside. There used to be a film... what do they call it?
Film... An office, like a state film office.
Yeah, something like that. They used to have like a...
Give tax breaks and things like that.
Well, exactly, yeah. In Wilmington, I think, was actually a pretty big part of the film scene.
Yeah, they called it Wilmywood. It's where Dawson's Creek was filmed.
That might be the biggest thing now that I think about it. The biggest thing filmed in North Carolina might have been Dawson's Creek.
I'm not going to argue with that, being a child of the 80s and 90s.
Days of Thunder was the movie I was thinking of, not Thunder Road.
Days of Thunder. Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, they met on the set of that movie, of course.
And the rest was history.
Yeah.
The Exorcist 3, shot in North Carolina.
Oh, that's classy. That's
classic.
Yeah. Wait, Days of Thunder, I'm at least familiar with.
I forgot a
even though
one.
It's a completely unrealistic depiction of NASCAR racing, even back in 1990. Except for the fact that one of the main cars was sponsored by Hardee's and another main car is sponsored by Mellow Yellow, that feels like it's right up the NASCAR alley.
Here's actually a really good one. I'm guessing you've seen The Fugitive.
Yes.
So.
Oh, the scene where where
the train jumps the tracks.
Yes,
hits the bus.
Mm-hmm.
That is in the Appalachian Mountains out in Westside, North Carolina.
Yeah.
They are still there. The train's remains are still there. You can go find them. You can Google it, and it's really kind
of
creepy.
Whole sequence, like right down to when he jumps off. Wait, isn't the whole sequence including like when he jumps into the water?
Yeah.
And then when they chase him, that whole part's that is all in North Carolina, I think.
And the train,
the
bus, it is all still there.
Oh my gosh!
This was not just like set And I guess nowadays you do it like in special effects or whatever, but
the terrain and the vegetation isn't quite the same in downstate Illinois as it is in western North Carolina, but they fooled everybody. Yeah, Swanee's showing it to me right now, the train escape scene and the crash and all that. Yeah, it looks like it's outside of Asheville.
Yeah, so if you're interested in those kind of things of finding weird remains from films or just weird abandoned things, there is a train wreck still in western North Carolina from the movie The Fugitive starring Harrison Ford. Great, great movie, by the way.
I didn't kill my wife.
I don't care.
That's just... You know what? The other thing I like about that movie, we're stretching this long, but there are these little slices of life scenes with the guys with the marshals that are investigating him. Like on the day he blends into the parade, one of them turns to Tommy Lee Jones and says, "If they can dye the river green today, why can't they dye it blue the other 364 days of the year?"
I actually got
and the other thing is like it becomes clear when they're when the U.S. Marshal when they're questioning the Chicago PD guys, they just give each other. There's so much that's communicated with looks in that movie. It's one of the things I like about it. The look that the marshals kind of shoot each other when the CPD guys are talking, like these guys are just full of blank. How can they believe this stuff? And this is their story, and they convicted the guy on it.
The Fugitive is actually the one thing my girlfriend asked me to get her for Christmas.
Really? Wow. It's good taste.
Yes. And this brings up a conversation we were just having in the office not too long ago, which gives you an idea of how much fun we sometimes like to
have. We do work here, just so you know. We do actually get some work done.
We do. However, we were talking about Men in Black, and I said that obviously my Men in Black name would be B for Ben. And they say, was it just like that? And I was like, yes, because J was James before. K became Kevin or something.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that was after. That was once he got kind of, he left MIB before they brought him back. And at the end of the first movie, the woman he met at the morgue, her name was Laurel. She became L.
L.
This is quite the crack code they came up with for this movie. I don't know how they thought that up.
I think there'd be a lot of redundancy.
You would think. They can only have like 26 agents at a time.
Yeah, and they have to have specific, you know, if you're coming up short on cues, that you better find a new agent named Quincy. And Xavier, you know, oh, we need an X. Okay, find me all the qualified people in the branches of the military and the NYPD named Xavier. Bring them in. Let's test them. See which one we want.
Or they start going through a double A. I'm double A. I'm double B.
Well, then would it be the initials like AA? You know, would
then have you're to giving be, too much away.
Would it
right?
have to be someone named Aaron A. Aronson?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't think they thought that far in advance.
Or maybe they say, or if they're coming up short, they say, okay, well, you could have your off your last name. So if they had an A, but they didn't have an M, I could be M. Mm-hmm. But I'd rather be M in James Bond than Men in Black.
Well, right. Everyone wants to be M. Or I would rather be Q.
Q's got all the devices, yeah. But M's the boss.
Yeah, but Q never has anyone coming after his head. He just gets to have fun and make things that blow up or do weird stuff.
Yeah, try to return him in one piece this time, Bond.
Who was the first Q?
God.
Because the second one was, what's his name from Fawlty Towers, right?
John Cleese.
Yes, John Cleese. The first Q.
I can picture him. Desmond Llewellyn. That's right. Desmond Llewellyn. Hmm. And he lasted a long time.
He did.
Yeah. Or actually, no, Peter Burton. My bad. I'm sorry. Desmond Llewellyn came in Let's see.
Well, Desmond Llewellyn is probably the most famous.
He came. One. Yeah, he came. Yeah, he came in from Russia with Love. Peter Burton was Dr. No. So Peter Burton was the first Q, and then it kind of.
Then they were like, enough of this guy.
Yeah, and they kind of. They went away.
Oh, I guess he had scheduling conflicts. That was a pretty big mistake.
Yeah. Lost a steady role, but then again, some people don't want to get stereotyped or typecast. They don't want it, so that's why some people turn down Star Wars. You don't want me typecasting. You don't want me remembered as, you know, that one thing. Of course, if you're a good enough actor, you'll get plenty of work, and if you're Hayden Christensen, you won't. Sorry, Hayden, if you're listening.
I was going to say, Peter Burton did do a lot of great movies. He was in Lawrence of Arabia. He was in Clockwork Orange. So he did a lot of good things other than James Bond movies, however. Desmond Llewellyn is always going to be remembered for being Q. And Hayden Christensen is going to be remembered for Star Wars Episode 3.
That's and pretty 2. Much,
he was in 2? Oh, that's right. He was in 2. I think the most lasting impression of those Star Wars. I'm probably going to end the podcast a little early.
Don't worry. We will have more Star Wars chatter later this season as well, I'm sure, as the new movie comes out.
Oh, but, yeah. The most lasting impact of the first of the prequel trilogy is the YouTube series, the Red Letter Media series, that just destroys them. So I'm thankful
they made
those.
What's the guy's name?
I can't remember. It's been a while since I've watched them.
Mr. Something or other, like,
as bad as they were, that was the best thing to come from them.
I watch those parodies more often than the movie.
I can't say I ever saw episode 2 or 3 after it came out in the theaters.
Mr. Plinkett. Yeah, like this. If you haven't watched it, is this dyspeptic voice, like in the character is,
frankly, it's sloppy. A movie
it's slobbing like just you hear him eating food. I think he's in Wisconsin.
Basically,
but beneath all that,
it's
single-handedly shreds. Every single aspect of the prequels,
and on route.
even the parts you might think are good, he just destroys.
And on that path, he finds love with his captive woman he kidnaps.
Yeah, it's
highly recommended from both your friends here at the Denver Broncos.
Oh, he had a reaction to the trailer for The Force Awakens last year.
We'll have to watch that.
Yeah, like the drawing of him that accompanies this is he's wearing sunglasses. He's got it looks like he hasn't washed his hair in about a week. He's missing several teeth. He's got what looks like a plate of toasted ravioli on his corpulent chest, and he's
that
wearing
was his
and
thing.
And he's
that was his thing,
yeah,
wasn't
and he, yeah, and he's wearing a tank top undershirt, white of course, classy.
Well,
like a white shirt. I mean, like it's. What, you know, there's a bad term for those undershirts. I'm not going to use it.
Yes. we're nearing an hour on this podcast here, so let's wrap this up. As you come up here to training camp, you can always find some of the best coverage available. I don't want to get down on some of my media peeps who do great work on their own, but you find great coverage here at DenverBroncos.com, the only place where you can find video highlights and also photos from during the team period from our own Eric Bakke, a master photographer. And then you'll also be able to find coverage from the NFL Hall of Fame weekend, Pro Football Hall of Fame weekend leading up to the first preseason game. And we'll be there from that. And so with that, we'll leave you until we come back in a week's time. Thanks for tuning in, and you can catch us on iTunes.